Sinisterhood is brought to you by Progressive Insurance.
Fiscally responsible financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds.
Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way.
Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Content warning. This episode contains allegations of the abuse of minors. Defendants at the heart of one of the 1990s most controversial cases are hoping to regain their freedom, while another defendant in Wisconsin's release was threatened. Plus, the embattled pastor at the heart of the Michael Miller case faces new allegations. This week's episode is Prior Case Updates.
A bump in the night, your heart fills with dread. Probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed, you'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinisterhood.
I'm gonna kill you.
We got some updates.
Whew, big ones. Taking over the headline banner on ABC News, kind of big updates. And normally we do these as true crime headlines bonus content on Patreon, but I won't lie, I'm petty. In the last case we're talking about today, I wanted this one to be on the main feed because I think everyone needs to know about this bastard and what he's been up to.
Truly. Yeah. And the Menendez brothers who we're going to talk about, I mean, that's been a case that people have been following for decades. Yes. I remember when it happened being in high school. So some of these people have been following for, 20 plus years.
Yeah. And it's shocking changes how quickly we will see how important local elections are, definitely. But these are ones that we've covered in the past. And, I think we would be remiss if we didn't continue the story, just given the massiveness of these updates.
Definitely. Well, I'm Christy.
I'm Heather.
And let's get into it. The decades-old case of Lyle and Eric Menendez has resurfaced as the brothers continue their fight for a new trial. Their request hinges on recently surfaced evidence of alleged sexual abuse by their father, Jose Menendez. In 1996, Lyle and Eric Menendez were convicted of first-degree murder, the 1989 killings of their parents in their Beverly Hills home. The prosecution argued that the brothers committed the murders to inherit their parents' fortune, while the defense claimed they acted in self-defense after enduring years of sexual and psychological abuse by their father. Both were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. We covered their case in episodes 46 and 47.
And definitely one that at the time we covered both of the trials, and this self-defense claim came in during one trial, but not the other. And that has been at the crux of their argument for release. But you can't just get out because you have alleged the same facts. You have to have a new piece of evidence.
Yeah. And was it Netflix or Hulu? Somebody came out with not a documentary. It was a Ryan Murphy.
Monsters as well as the docuseries. Yeah. And yeah, there's been a lot of renewed interest here in the past year, I think because of their filing.
Yeah. In May of 2023, the brothers' legal team filed a habeas corpus petition, presenting new evidence to support their claims of abuse. This included a 1988 letter allegedly written by Eric Menendez to his cousin, detailing the ongoing abuse, and allegations from Roy Rosello, former member of the boy band Menudo, who claimed he was sexually assaulted by Jose Menendez when he was 14.
And so that is the physical evidence, is this letter that was allegedly in this box that their cousin had in storage. The cousin passed away. They get the letter out. And then also Roy Rosello comes forward and is willing to speak on the record. So that gives you the door opening to file this habeas petition when you've already had your case, you know, adjudicated. This is what was at the center of that Peacock docuseries. That was kind of the first one that came out interviewing, because this Menudo connection was like, oh shit, it was not just his own kids, allegedly.
Yeah. And then no other victim has come out, but it does make you wonder if there were victims other than his sons, how far did that extend? Mm-hmm. Was, you know, was Roy the only one?
Well, especially if he had access via this, the boy band.
The previous Los Angeles County District Attorney, George Gaston, indicated support for resentencing the Menendez brothers. In October of 2024, Gaston announced his decision to recommend the resentencing of Eric and Lyle, acknowledging their approximately 35 years in custody, and adding,
"We also acknowledge Eric and Lyle's continuous rehabilitative efforts during their incarceration." So they have. They've been participating and helping other inmates and creating things and whatnot. And so the attorney, the district attorney over LA County as of last year, we thought they were headed for freedom because the habeas petition is pending. That's one avenue to freedom. A motion for resentencing was filed, which is another avenue of freedom. And then you could also just get pardoned by the governor. So they had kind of three potential pathways. So now they've got two pathways open as of last October. So they've been feeling very positive.
And they really have shown a total, I mean, what we want to see the prison system do is rehabilitate people. And they've both kind of found their own paths of leading like religious groups and mentoring other prisoners and stuff. And they've been model prisoners this entire time. So to be sentenced for something you did as a teen and you're sentenced for life without parole. I mean, we've said before when we covered their first cases, of course, we don't condone what they did.
No.
But you can hold two truths in your hands at the same time. They were viciously abused by their father, which gives some context to why they felt like they didn't have an out other than murdering them.
No, you're right. And I think that the idea of life without parole for a teenager is one of the core tenets of the Equal Justice Initiative. And that idea that primarily, this is generally speaking, primarily the children who are sentenced as adults are Black and brown children from non-affluent neighborhoods. These obviously vastly different. You know, they were extremely wealthy and had a lot of opportunities and privilege. However, that doesn't mean that they were not also undergoing some sort of heinous abuse behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And not really quite behind closed doors if there were witnesses.
True. Yeah. And a lot of times, I think it's almost harder for kids that do have a lot of privilege and wealth to be believed because outsiders just can't imagine that someone that's, you know, this wealthy and lives in Beverly Hills and his sons play tennis and he's known around the country club could also be sexually abusing his kids.
Yeah. And I think it's not believing him for a different set of reasons that are just as insidious. So it's like even an abused kid is an abused kid, like regardless of the niceness of their home. And you're right. There's different reasons why people will overlook it. It's like the poorer kids may not even get hurt. And those kids, it's like, but your dad, he manages Menudo.
Yeah. However, the brothers' resentencing hearing was postponed following November's Los Angeles District Attorney election and has been rescheduled to March 20th and 21st. Gascon's successor, Nathan Hotchman, who assumed office in November of 2024, has opposed granting a new trial to the brothers. Hotchman has questioned the credibility of the evidence presented by the defense, including allegations of sexual abuse by their father, Jose. He stated,
"We argue in many different ways. It is not credible evidence."
Referring to a letter allegedly written by Eric Menendez detailing the abuse. Hotchman has questioned the authenticity of the 1988 letter, noting the difficulty in verifying its origin due to the cousin's passing in 2003. Hotchman also stated the Rosello's allegations, while serious, were not known to the brothers at the time of the murders, and therefore do not directly pertain to their state of mind during the crime.
So one election of a local official has now potentially shut the door on freedom for these guys.
And you have to ask, I mean, he gives his reasons, but like, why is this your hill to die on? You know what I mean? Like, this case, they've been in prison for 30 some odd years. Like, are there not more pressing matters at hand?
It's almost like a, my opponent wanted them out. Yeah. So therefore I'm like being contrarian almost. Mm-hmm. And it's, I have not heard anyone else say, we doubt the authenticity of this letter, even, you know, the prior DA or whatever. And if that was true, I don't think that the brothers' attorneys would move forward with a habeas petition, because that means all of their legal team is lying to a court.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what is that? What is more likely? A single DA has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder and wants to be a talking head on Fox News, which he already has been with this, or the whole entire Menendez legal team is full of shit and making stuff
up? Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's a feather in his cap to, you know, not allow them to get out, but also he's going to get a lot of airtime because he's stirring the pot instead of just going along with it. And it does seem rather contrarian. And I think you got to separate that from the facts and what's right when you're a DA.
For sure. It's like you need to focus. The DA needs to just focus on the truth and not, this will be politically helpful for me.
Right.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't the subject of the letter come up in one of the trials? They didn't have it, but one of the brothers said that he had written to his cousin.
I feel like he forgot that he wrote it, but he said he had told his cousin. He knew about it. I told family members about it, but they did not have this evidence until the cousin passed away.
Yeah. Okay. Lyle Menendez responded to Hotchman's stance, expressing profound disappointment. In a statement, he said,
"He opened the wounds we have spent decades trying to heal. He didn't listen to us."
Roy Rosello, supporting the brothers' claim, stated,
"I went through similar abuse with Jose Menendez and Eduardo Diaz, the Menudo creator, which is my fight now, to put this pedophile in jail." So it's like, this guy's coming out of the woodwork, not because it's going to like do good for him. It's now you could potentially get sued for defamation by this guy that's still alive. Like, it coming out with your story of childhood sexual abuse publicly in one of the most contentious trials of, you know, the past 30 years. Like, that is not something you do lightly, in my opinion.
And people that say, you know, they do this because they want media attention or whatever. Like you just said, do you think anybody wants to blow up their whole life in their adult to be like, relive all of this traumatic abuse they suffered at the hands of two adults that they trusted in their formative years? So it's not just Jose that Roy was abused by, but he alleges that the creator of Menudo was also sexually abusing him. And what were there, five boys in Menudo, I believe?
I think five or six, yeah.
Yeah.
At different times.
So was it just Roy?
Yeah.
And was it just Menudo?
Exactly. And I mean, we've never covered it, but I know Lou Pearlman, the NSYNC Backstreet Boys guy, allegations of like, you know, hey, it's band. We're getting together to do like band team building. Now we're all going to go swimming in my pool together and we're all going to drink wine, even though you're all 15. Like shit like that goes on. Like you said, nobody wants to come forward absent you want to tell your truth to get this person A, off the streets, and B, apparently it will help these people who were your fellow victims. I don't think he has any other reason to go to bat for the Menendez brothers.
No, it doesn't make any sense. And what was the guy's name? The Nickelodeon piece of
Dan
shit?
Dan Schneider.
Yeah, it's giving Dan Schneider a lot too.
Weird.
Same with Lou Pearlman. Mm-hmm. Of like, we're just all hanging out on set and we're just going to drink and you're 14, but whatever. It loosens you up a bit.
Let me give you a foot rub.
Grooming at its finest. Mm-hmm.
Sinisterhood will be right back. Sinisterhood is brought to you by Progressive Insurance.
Fiscally responsible financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds.
Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way.
Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
The brothers gave an exclusive interview to the Two Angry Men podcast in late February, in which they shared their prison experience. Eric told host Harvey Levin, who also hosts TV show TMZ,
"Prison was hard for me. I faced a lot of bullying and trauma. It was a dangerous environment."
Speaking in a separate phone call with the hosts, Lyle expressed optimism. He described his involvement in a prison-based green space project and said he would like to continue working on the project even if granted release.
Yeah, I mean, they both suffered a lot of abuse. They talked about being separated. And, you know, when Eric heard Lyle was like beaten in a separate prison, he's like, "I was completely crushed because I couldn't be there to like protect my brother." So just kind of the empathetic human side of it.
It's gut-wrenching when you think about how long these men now have suffered abuse. I mean, from the time they were 8 years old, and now they're in prison. So, I mean, their whole childhood, teenage years, and adulthood were, I want to say, stolen from them, especially when they're younger. But yes, they did viciously murder their parents and rightfully went to prison. At some point, though, are we not like, my God, they've paid their dues.
Right. And the question is, what's the purpose of prison? And if it is, they took Jose and Kitty's life, therefore they should be in prison for life, period, full stop, then we don't need to have juries. We don't need to have sentencing. We don't need to have mitigating circumstance factors. We can just get Dr. Death, you know, James Grigson, to go in and go, "They're a killer once and forever," and then put them all to death. And we don't want a system like that, right?
No.
You want a system where you're considerate of something. You're like, oh my God, a normal average kid does not shotgun blast their parents. What in the world would cause this kid to do this? And that becomes the question, and they're willing to tell you the question. There are people who just go, full stop, no, it never happened, which we're about to talk about, including people related to them. But there just has now become such corroborating evidence that it's like, I think you should consider that. Like you said, hold two truths in the same time. Like, that is a terrible thing you've done, but I can see what led to it. And those factors have now been mitigated through the rehabilitation.
Some members of the Menendez family have expressed disappointment in Hotchman's stance, while others appreciate that he opposes the brothers' release. Their uncle, Milton Anderson, was an outspoken advocate against their release. He repeatedly denied that any abuse of the boys took place and was vehemently opposed to any reduction in sentence. Well, how would he really know one way or the other? You know what I mean? Like, just because you come out and say, "I 100% it didn't happen," who are we going to believe? The uncle or the victims?
My thing is, like, you didn't live there. If it was like, "I lived with them from age blank to blank and nothing ever happened." But even then, you're not with that kid 24/7. And also, no offense, I don't know that definitionally what happened. Sometimes an older person would construe that as abuse. And by that, I mean, Jose, in addition to the allegations of the severe sexual abuse, he openly, in front of the brothers' friends that everybody saw. So to me, Anderson's position is quite weakened, given that we heard from friends be like, "No, Jose would like smash a tennis racket over Eric's head or scream at his face or call him these swear words or tell him." It made me think of how like Aaron Hernandez's dad would treat him, like the screaming, the pressure, the sports pressure. So perhaps to an older adult that grew up in a time where it was fine to scream in your kid's face, he's like, "Those kids weren't abused. He was just making them into men." And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? We know he at the very minimum verbally and physically abused them, like hit them and bruised them. So for you to say nothing ever happened 100%, I'm like, well, now your entire stance is meaningless to me.
It's diminished and watered down, because to me, I would say, well, so you don't consider all of these things that are facts that we have proof, definitive proof of abuse?
Yeah.
Well, it is. But if you don't think it is, then like, what else don't you think is abuse? Or what else are you not allowing your brain to kind of go there?
Yeah.
You know, if this, then what?
He would just say like, no, no matter what, they were not sexually abused, period. And it's just like, you weren't fucking there all the time. You just
have to, it's kind of sus too when someone is that wasn't there and couldn't have known is so adamant. It gives a bit, "He doth protest too much."
Yeah, like, what's going on? Why are you so obsessed with keeping them in jail?
Anderson died on March 3rd, but not before meeting with Hotchman. Anderson's former attorney, Kathleen Cady, told Fox News before Anderson's death.
It's Milton Anderson's continued belief that the claims of molestation were made up and they were false, and he believes that the correct verdict was issued by the jury and the correct sentence was also committed.
Anderson's attorney later recused himself from his representation in order to take a new role within the DA's office.
So Kathleen Cady was representing the uncle who said nothing ever happened, nothing ever happened, suddenly recuses herself and then goes to work for now Nathan Hotchman?
Interesting.
Weird. I don't know. Just a weird thing I noted.
Switch sides. Went once, I guess, you could. He's not in the picture anymore.
Yeah, or you're like, well, this new DA agrees with me, so I'm just going to go work for him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a statement, other relatives criticized Hotchman's dismissal of the new evidence and highlighted the lasting impact of abuse on victims. They also expressed gratitude toward California Governor Gavin Newsom for directing the state parole board to conduct a comprehensive risk assessment to evaluate whether the brothers would pose a threat to public safety if released. In his announcement on February 26, Governor Newsom reminded the family and public,
"There's no guarantee of outcome here, but this process simply provides more transparency as well as provides us more due diligence before I make any determination for clemency." So that's kind of the third one I talked about, that clemency. He could grant clemency and let the brothers out under the governor could. He could do that today. But I think he is mindful of the politics and wants to say, well, the parole board told me that they're not a threat anymore. Therefore, I agree with the parole board. It kind of helps like alleviate sole responsibility on your shoulders. Although I don't know that they're going to, it's like they weren't out, you know, thrill killing for fun. It seemed like a very specific thing for a very specific reason. So, but we'll see what the parole board says, I guess.
Yeah. The people that argue, no, they just killed him for their money.
Yeah.
Perhaps might be like, well, they're just, you know, going to kill somebody else for their money. But that just is a stupid reasoning to me. Like, I don't think they killed their parents just for money. There's a ton of abuse going on. And I think the not favorable light that they, you know, put themselves in right after with buying Rolexes and sports cars and stuff.
Yeah.
That was a bad look. But everybody kind of goes through trauma differently. And who am I to judge like what they do with the money of the people that had been abusing them? Because their mom, there were some allegations there too. At the very least, complicit. They said she knew what was going on.
Yeah, complicit and kind of kept her head in the sand about what was going on. Yeah.
On March 9th, a cousin, Tammy Goodell, reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office Civil Rights Division, complaining that Hotchman was
hostile, dismissive, and patronizing
during meetings, adding,
"His lack of compassion was palpable, and the family left feeling not only ignored, but further intimidated and re-victimized."
She requested that Hotchman be removed from the case.
So this is fresh. So we'll see if the U.S. Attorney's Office of Civil Rights want to reach out. But that's who you would complain to about an elected state official that is potentially trampling your constitutional rights.
On Monday, March 10th, D.A. Hotchman held a press conference in which he asked the court to withdraw the previous district attorney's motion for resentencing, saying,
"We believe there are legitimate reasons and the interest of justice justifies that withdrawal."
He explained the decision was
based on the current state of the record and the Menendez brothers' current and continual failure to show full insight and accept full responsibility for their murders.
The DA's statement indicated a way forward for the brothers, saying,
"If they were to finally come forward and unequivocally and sincerely admit and completely accept responsibility for their lies of self-defense and the attempted suborning of perjury they engaged in, then the court should weigh such new insight into the analysis of rehabilitation and resentencing, as will the people."
In late February, Hotchman already asked the court to deny the brothers' pending habeas petition. Monday's request to withdraw the motion for resentencing threatens another of three paths to freedom for Eric and Lyle.
Yeah, so the state before was sort of on board with the habeas petition and was cooperating and also was on board with the motion for resentencing and was going to leave it up to a judge to decide, like, you know, you've done 30 years, whatever. We think that that's sufficient under the facts and circumstances of the case. But now Hotchman's turned and he's like, nope on that, nope on that. And he's basically said, if Newsom wants to let him out, Newsom can let him out. But we're fighting this.
Yeah, it all seems political and for his own personal gain. And it's also giving, have you even said thank you once during this meeting? Like, what do you mean? They're not boys anymore. They got to come out and be like, I'm sorry, everybody. I did. Like, a jury already found them guilty. Mm-hmm. They've done their time. Mm-hmm. And now all you're saying it would take is for them to be vocal about their regret. Perhaps they don't regret it.
Well, I was going to say, and it sounds like he's like, I want you to come forward and say that you were never abused. And it's like, well, now you've been, as a prisoner, you've been locked up and you want to tell your truth. You thought you had an opportunity to tell your truth. And now, because by virtue of an election, which again, I will reiterate, local elections are important for reasons mm-hmm. such as this. It's like, now we have the Los Angeles County wasting, in my opinion, resources fighting this. So now he's throwing a fucking press conference. Again, why, if it were something that was mechanical, procedural, whatever? No. Mr. Hotchman wants to be behind the podium because he's in charge. He's a big man in charge.
And I feel like the work had already been done by the previous DA. And he's just coming in and just to be the opposite is taking a defiant stance about it all.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's because he wants to be a talking head and it's political. Mm-hmm.
You can agree with people. It's okay to agree with people, even if maybe they're your opponent or you replace them. I think that there's a lot of credibility and class when people do that. I think more of someone if they're able to see like beyond their own selfishness to agree with someone that might not be in their camp.
No, I agree. And I think it would be, I would have way more respect for him if he came in and said, granted, like saying, you know, I am new to this, so I can't proceed as assuredly as my predecessor could, like, because they did more work than me, although not everybody from the whole office is like fired and gone, like you're just their new boss. Ask your employees. But instead, and saying, I'm going to now do a more thorough review for myself so that I also, but instead it's like, oh no, I don't think those letters are right. Like, okay, then come forward and say, mm-hmm. for the following reasons, we analyzed the paper actually was manufactured in 2015. So we know that this is fake, that this was not written back in the day, that it was, then that's fine. Then we would all listen to you.
The handwriting doesn't match. We found a handwriting sample from the cousin in the past.
The stuff that it was in the box was very clearly new stuff. But no, it was just like, oh no, it feels sus. Like what?
You're not the fact finder. Yeah, you can't just say that. You got to back it up with something. Mm-mm. A resentencing hearing is still scheduled for March 20th or 21st of 2025, though the outcome seems less clear than under the prior DA. Even so, Lyle said in their recent podcast interview,
my brother and I are cautiously hopeful. We're in prayer with our family and we're hopeful and we're just trying not to go a little crazy in the interim.
The case has regained public attention in the past year, partly due to the Netflix series Monsters, which dramatized the brother's story, and a subsequent documentary. Initially critical of the series, the brothers have since acknowledged that it has raised awareness about the abuse they allegedly suffered. Lyle Menendez noted that the show educated viewers about the potential horrors occurring behind closed doors, even in affluent households.
And I think that's one thing to say about it is sometimes a dramatization will have draw people in and have them watch in a way that not everybody's going to watch a docuseries, perhaps.
Yeah, so that is true.
It does help.
I haven't watched it. I heard that it was very dramatized. I'm also not a big Ryan Murphy fan. Mm-hmm. I heard they put a weird spin on it as if the brothers had some kind of relationship with each other, which has never come out in any evidence or anything I've researched.
No, they've always been like close brothers, but I never, until the Ryan Murphy adaptation, I never had any inkling that they had any sort of incestual thing going on between them. But that was an odd artistic choice by Ryan Murphy. But sadly, this week as well, as this was all getting announced, a young man in Wisconsin actually killed his mother and specifically cited the Menendez documentary on Netflix as inspiration for the act. He said that particularly the scene depicting the killing of Jose and Kitty, like gave him, it said the idea, quote, came to him and he killed his mother and then was going to kill his father, but in fact did not obtain a weapon that he found sufficient. He Snapchatted a picture to a friend and then the friend called 911 and police came and arrested him. He was just 15.
Did he allege that he was being abused by his parents?
He has not said that. It just said that the he told investigators that the idea to kill his parents came to him while he was watching the series. But yeah.
Well, that's... Oh, man. Anytime something like that happens and it's tragic, you kind of get the whole, and he's a piece of shit now, or always has been, but now we know, like the Marilyn Manson defense of like, well, the music told him to do it, or the, you know, this media told him to do it. Maybe it did give somebody an idea, but that doesn't make someone a murderer. All of that is there long before. You don't watch a TV show and see something and just, as a stable person, mentally go, yeah, that seems like a cool idea. I'm going to try that.
Yeah, it's my understanding he was sneaking his brother's medication, anxiety medication, and had been taking a lot of it and said he took some that night and stuff. So, like I said, the dad survived and has asked the court to still have contact with his son. So given that he is 15, one would hope there would be some rehabilitation or something, but they are holding him currently as an adult, and I believe he'll be tried as an adult.
Well, we'll keep you updated on that one as well.
Mm-hmm. Sinisterhood will be right back. Sinisterhood is brought to you by Progressive Insurance.
Fiscally responsible financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds.
Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way.
Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Well, now we're going to talk about another case that had a docuseries about it and has been going on for a decade now, I guess.
Mm-hmm. One of our very earliest episodes.
Yeah, it was. In Wisconsin, a judge has upheld the release of Morgan Geiser, one of the two women convicted in the 2014 Slender Man stabbing case. In May of 2014, 12-year-olds Morgan Geiser and Anissa Wire lured their classmate, Peyton Lutner, to a park in Waukesha, Wisconsin, after a sleepover. There, Geiser stabbed Lutner 19 times while Wire encouraged her. Lutner survived the attack by crawling out of the woods and finding help from a passing bicyclist. The assailants later told investigators they committed the act to become servants of the fictional character Slender Man and to protect their families from him. We covered this case in episode 15. In 2017, Geiser pleaded guilty to attempted first-degree intentional homicide, but was found not criminally responsible due to mental illness. Consequently, in 2018, she was committed to the Winnebago Mental Health Institute for 40 years, with the ability to petition for release every 6 months. Wire, who pleaded guilty to attempted second-degree intentional homicide, was committed to a psychiatric hospital for 25 years, was granted conditional release in 2021 under supervision, including living with her father and wearing a GPS monitor.
And the details of this, which we talk about in our episode, are very tragic. Just having a sleepover with a victim and making her feel like she was part of it. They were going to have donuts or pancakes or whatever in the morning, and then to lure her to a place and very savagely attack her.
Anytime you hear kids doing something like this at this age to another kid that's their age, it's a whole different ball of wax, I think. Especially, they had been planning it for months.
Yeah, months. Yeah. Because of this and fixation on Slender Man and the creepypasta.
And this girl had no idea that these people that claimed to be her friends were really just kind of grooming her to trust them so they could lure her out to these woods.
There's something insidious about that, too, of like, even if for a day or two, but much less, much longer than that, that someone knows that they're going to hurt you and harm you.
Yeah. Since June of 2022, Geiser has petitioned for conditional release 4 times. She withdrew her first 2 petitions, and the third was denied in April of 2024, with the court citing ongoing public safety concerns. In October of 2024, Geiser filed her 4th petition for release. During a hearing in January of 2025, 3 psychologists testified to her significant progress in treatment, noting improved coping skills and emotional control. One expert warned that prolonged confinement could hinder her reintegration into society. Based on this testimony, Waukesha County Circuit Judge Michael Bowron ordered her conditional release, pending the development of a community supervision and housing plan by state and county health officials.
And if you all have been following along on True Crime Headlines on Patreon, this is the last update we provided you that she's been granted conditional release pending this plan that came out. And then another piece of news came out in the interim.
As the 60-day deadline to present the release plan approached, state health officials raised concern about Geiser's behavior. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services filed a report which cited 2 reasons for wanting her conditional release to be revoked, focused on a book and contact with a man. They alleged that she had been reading a novel about murder and organ trafficking called Rent Boy and communicating with a man who collects murder memorabilia, sending him violent artwork.
I looked up Rent Boy, and it seems like it is a satirical novel, and it's sort of similar to Catcher in the Rye-ish in that there's like the main character is kind of like on this like journey and interacts with people. And then it's my understanding the main character meets with a person who has this like organ harvesting scheme, but it's sort of this like hyper realistic, like almost Idiocracy-ish, like over the top, although we do live in Idiocracy now. But when it first came out, it seemed like it was unrealistic. Right. So that's you start to question like, okay, well, how much does a violent book have an impact on an inmate, or does it?
Yeah. I mean, a violent scene in a movie seemed to have a huge impact on a 15-year-old. So
yeah,
and you never know.
And especially if it's like my crime was committed because I was led to believe by reading this thing that Slender Man was going to hurt my family. And I read this thing and I believed it and I followed this thing I read. On that note, I could see why a state health official would go, now, hang on a minute.
Yeah, kind of unaware of the lines between fiction and fantasy.
That's the question, yeah.
Mm-hmm. During a hearing on February 8, 2025, these concerns led prosecutors to request the revocation of her release. Deputy District Attorney Abby Nicolai argued,
the reading material that she's so focused on has themes of sexual sadism and murder and the sale of human organs on the black market. All of these things that the treatment team at Winnebago had no idea she was so interested in.
Okay. Yes, she did a horrible thing. I don't know that we can draw the definite conclusion that because she's reading a fictional book about these topics, that she's so interested in them.
Yeah, being in a book banny kind of society now, which is like a crazy place to be, you know, given the 80s, and you know, Fahrenheit 451, 1984, all that kind of stuff. On the one hand, you want to be, as a district attorney, you're like, I have to be concerned about public welfare. But on the other hand, that's a great question of like, at what point can you, 3 different psychologists have all been like, she's fine. She has like emotional control. And like, are we continuing to punish a person who has been rehabilitated, at least insofar as these 3 experts that testified back in January, that she's like not allowed to read a book that might be satirical and have these elements? I mean, it's like, well, she was on a release plan and she went to the movie theater and saw this movie. And in this movie, there was murder. And when she came out, she gave it a good review on her Letterboxd account. So that means that she's a murderer. We got to take her in. It's like, it was a horror film. Like,
yeah.
We go to see horror films. We watch them all the time. Like,
yeah. It's, so, I also would ask the question of how was she reading this book in a psychiatric facility and nobody knew
so
that
bad.
She was?
Right.
Did she, so where is she getting it?
From this facility was her attorney's argument.
Why do you have it there then? Mm-hmm. If it's so bad that you're like, nobody here should be reading this, then do your due diligence and monitor that before it gets on the shelves.
Yeah, why did the facility approve this? Certainly.
Mm-hmm. Geiser's attorney, Tony Cotton, argued that she read only materials approved by the facility and that hospital staff were aware of her communications. He added that his client had no interest in further contact with the murder memorabilia collector who had pursued contact with her. Cotton told the court,
"We already crossed that bridge. We know there's people who will be fixated on her because those people have their own issues for whatever reason. She can't control that."
He emphasized that no release conditions had been set yet, so none could have been violated.
And that's the point, is like, you know, she got a letter from somebody maybe that says, "Hey, I'm interested, you know, do you want to send me artwork?" And if you don't know exactly who they are, it's just, it seems like a person that's a supporter writing to you and you send them artwork. And then they write back and are like, "You know, I could sell this for $50 since you stabbed someone." And you're like, "Oh shit, yikes. I did not know that's who that was. Mm-hmm. Oh no, please don't send me letters from him anymore." And then all of a sudden the DA is like, "She wrote a letter to this person." It's like, well, I was responding to mail.
Yeah. Again, do you read the mail coming in? I don't know. I don't know if it's like a prison where they monitor that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's my understanding that, the hospital staff screened it. So
you're screening it and approving it. And then something comes back you don't like. So I don't want to use the word entrapment. That seems a bit extreme. But you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if this is so concerning, why didn't it raise a red flag before it even got to her?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, I was sitting in the you know, common room reading this book in front of everybody. I'm not like, I had it secretly. I mean, I don't know that that's the case, but insofar as the materials her attorney says were approved by the facility, it's like somebody was on notice. How is it that, like, after the psychologist and everybody testify, all of a sudden you're like, now hang on a minute.
Mm-hmm. On March 6, 2025, Judge Bowron reviewed the state's concerns and found them insufficient to revoke Geiser's release. He stated,
"I don't see the risk to the public,"
and allowed the conditional release to proceed as planned. A hearing to finalize the release plan is scheduled for March 21st, 2025.
So, books be damned. It sounds like she's still headed for a final hearing to determine where she'll live, where she'll go, and all that good stuff.
In just a couple weeks.
Just a couple of weeks.
Have we heard from the victim? Has she come out at all and said how she feels about any of this?
As far as the victim, I'd have to dig deeper. It does seem like that she's does not come forward and do a ton. Like, if you search this and then search up, like, recent news, if she does do interviews, they're not, you know, she's not, like, on the front page trying to really make, I think she wants to move on with her life.
I respect that.
Yeah.
I'd be concerned for sure if, you know, the person that tried to kill me was getting out.
Mm-hmm.
I also wouldn't want to be just splashed across the newspapers and that stuff. I'd want to have my privacy and move on with my life too.
Yeah, you might not want to be forever associated with that, even though that, you know, somebody Googles your name, that's mm-hmm. like the first thing that comes up. Similar to the Menendez brothers, though, I think both of the Slender Man assailants is that they were engaging in a specific behavior predicated by specific circumstances that sound, which included severe untreated mental health suffering that I do think has been at least addressed, if not, it sounds like, according to the experts that have worked with them for the past 10 years, has been mitigated to the point that they're free.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep you updated on that. And now we move on to one of the biggest sacks of shit we've ever covered before, J.P. Miller.
The biggest.
In Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, embattled pastor John Paul Miller is facing growing legal battles and public scrutiny following the death of his wife, Micah Frances Miller, in April of 2024. Miller has now filed multiple lawsuits against individuals associated with the Justice for Micah movement, a group that has been demanding answers and questioning the official ruling of her death. We covered this case in episodes 294 through 296. Micah Miller was found dead from a gunshot wound in North Carolina's Lumber River State Park on April 27, 2024. Her death was ruled a suicide, but its circumstances have been widely debated, with some alleging inconsistencies in the investigation. The case has ignited ongoing protests, online campaigns, and public criticism aimed at Miller, who was Micah's husband at the time of her passing.
You know, it's all sort of surrounding that fucking crazy video of him preaching moments after he just goes, "Yeah, by the way, she died last night. Anyway, nobody talk about it. Things are crazy. Whew, have a good week."
I remember seeing that TikTok and was like, "What is this case?" And then went down the rabbit hole and I was like, "Holy shit." Because the lack of seeming emotion he has and just the day after this happened was wild. And then not even exaggerating, saying, nobody talk about this.
Yeah.
No one in the congregation is allowed to talk about this. Just rise from your seats and leave. When she had been a loved member of this congregation, it wasn't like it was a stranger to these people. They all knew her very well.
No, exactly. He didn't come in and go, my cousin who lives in Albany, who none of you've met, died, and we were very close, and I don't want to talk about it right now. It's like the co-leader of the church that used to sing with them. He's like, anyway, she's been shot. Eh, don't worry about it, though. Just everybody, and like, not crying. It's bananas. And that's really what it got our interest. And then, and so, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, and it was ablaze.
Yeah. He even indicated, when speaking to the congregation, implied that it was suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And even when she was alive, put her business out on blast all the time of mental health struggles she was suffering. And then after she was dead, he did the same, like reminding everyone, y'all know how much she'd been struggling and we'd all been trying to help her and planting these seeds before an investigation had even begun.
Yeah, exactly. It's listen to all three episodes, because we really definitely, I feel like we tore him apart in every possible way and all the evidence that was available then. And then all the stuff we're about to discuss now, I will say, doesn't help his case.
Nope. Now, in a legal counteroffensive, Miller has filed at least 10 lawsuits in Horry County against members of the Justice for Micah movement. He alleges that these individuals have engaged in
extreme stalking and harassment, which has made me fearful, tarnished my reputation, and thwarted my ministry.
His father, Reginald Wayne Miller, along with two former Solid Rock Church members, have filed an additional 14 lawsuits against the same group of activists.
And I don't want anyone to think I'm not being serious about what he did to Micah Miller, and both, I think, at the end of her life as well as throughout her life. But I fucking hate the guy, and he's huge narcissist who thinks he's cool, and he's a fucking tool. He wears Spider-Man outfits. He makes the most embarrassing fucking TikToks you've ever seen. He drives embarrassing cars. He dresses embarrassingly. He behaves embarrassingly. And the really horrible thing underneath it is that this embarrassing facade of like a huge fucking dork, on top of the fact that he is a severe significant sexual predator underneath it all. It's like freakish how much of a sex predator he is.
It did not start with Micah. It did not end with Micah.
No.
And his father was right there along with him.
Oh,
perhaps that's where he learned it from.
It is indeed. And we're getting to old Reginald here in a minute, too.
The lawsuits have triggered counterclaims, with one revealing that Miller preemptively ordered Micah's charity website, Dare to Care Missions, to be
dedicated to Micah Miller
just 3 days before her passing. This revelation has further fueled speculation about the timeline leading up to her death. The cases remain pending.
Yeah, something like that. That seems like some shit he would do, in my opinion, that he would be like, well, I'll kill her, and I'm going to have to do this part, and I have to clean up this, because there, in addition to the sex predator, in addition to being very abusive and stalking his wife and being a horrible stalker, on top of all of that, and this is all stuff that, if you go back to our episodes, we have like receipts for these things that happen. I'm speaking in a, based upon the evidence, my legal opinion is. Mm-hmm. And on top of all of that, you have these allegations of financial improprieties. And what I have seen in the evidence is that they have used these various church entities as their little piggy banks. And this mission that Micah had separately was supposed to be separate money for her to do some ministry in Africa. And this man wanted such dominion and control over her that he could not stand that she had a separate ministry, like mission that didn't have to do with him.
Mm-mm. No. And 3 days before, you're going to have a dedicated.
Yeah. In loving memory, bitch, I'm still here.
Yeah. No, but that's indicative of kind of how he did everything. He was convinced he was the smartest person in every room and was untouchable. Like nobody was going to put two and two together to figure out what he'd done.
Yeah. I mean, when you get away with shit for this long, you probably do think you're untouchable.
True.
Sinister Hood will be right back. Sinister Hood is brought to you by Progressive Insurance.
Fiscally responsible financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds.
Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way.
Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
As these legal battles unfold, Miller has also been linked to the establishment of new religious organizations following the closure of Solid Rock Church, where he previously served as a pastor.
Yeah, you got to get that stank off you. You got to get a new name, rebrand.
Yeah, Solid Rock Church is, people were still going even after, but a lot of people were also protesting out front. So you got to shut it down at some point. It's disgusting that he was able to just set up shop somewhere else that quickly.
Oh, yeah. That's what they've been doing this whole time.
Mm-hmm. In October of 2024, J.P. Miller filed paperwork to establish Living Water Church at Market Common, listing his personal residence as the business address for the new ministry. Not long after, associates connected to him registered two additional ministries. Mercy Church Ministries was initially listed under an invalid address, but later updated to a mailbox rental service in Myrtle Beach. The registered agent is Miller's maternal grandmother, Molly Fleming. Another, called Forge Church, is registered with ties to Miller's inner circle, according to public records.
And local South Carolina journalists do not have an easy job between J.P. Miller and Alec Murdoch being around. And like Fitz News has been there, Post and Courier, like, they, you know, the devil works hard, but J.P. Miller works harder. And it's like, just to try to keep up with all the shit he's doing, they stay on it, which is good. You got to.
Yeah. I hate that he has an inner circle that even still believes his bullshit to allow this stuff. His grandmother, who knows, you know? I mean, maybe she doesn't even know what she's signed up for.
It's just her name. Yeah. It's like some black people say, like, if you're sitting at a dinner party and one person's a Nazi, that's actually a dinner party full of Nazis. I'm like, if you have an inner circle and one, and now his dad is also an adjudicated sex predator, I'm like, you now have two sex, you're all sex predators then. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're just chilling with this dude.
Oh, I mean, they were in his congregation.
Yeah,
we talked about the episodes. Yeah. Openly admitted, like, I thought, you know, I would be cured of this if I came here. And it's like, or you'd find like-minded people.
Yeah, and you'd have access, unfettered access, which is some of the allegations we're about to get into, to a lot of teens.
The FBI searched Miller's residence back in October of 2024. The federal investigation into Miller has been the subject of speculation. Some believe it is tied to Micah Miller's death, while others believe it is linked to the purportedly shaded history of his church's finances and the religious empire of his father, Reginald Wayne Miller.
Which we discussed it in the prior episodes, but his dad did get busted for having workers at the church. Like, there was some like labor issues if they were working without being paid or not being paid enough and things like that, in addition to all these allegations of sexual impropriety. And before Micah passed, she had said to someone, "I called the IRS on JP." And it is the allegation of both Micah as well as others who have been involved that JP and his dad treat the churches like they're their own piggy banks. They use church assets to buy stuff. They sell stuff not at arm's length with the church, which, like, you are just asking for either the IRS or the state court system to say, we're going to pierce the corporate veil. Like, you're no longer protected by this entity because you don't respect the entity. You're just, you're treating it like it doesn't exist. So we're going to treat it like it doesn't exist, which is what you love to hear, because that means they can sue the shit out of JP and he can't try to be shielded by any of his assets or any of his entities.
They used it as a personal piggy bank and a personal playground for sexual deviancy.
For sure.
That empire is under even more scrutiny with the filing of two more lawsuits. The first was filed on February 25th, 2025, and the second on March 5th, with both listing J.P. Miller, his father Reginald Wayne Miller, and their various entities as defendants. The lawsuits, filed separately by plaintiffs identified as Jane Doe 1 and Jane Doe 2, accused John Paul and his father of using their positions as pastors to groom, abuse, and silence victims while church leadership allegedly enabled and covered up their actions. The allegations span more than 40 years, painting a picture of a religious empire that, according to the lawsuits, was built not just to serve God, but to serve the Millers' predatory behavior. The lawsuits describe a disturbing cycle. Victims say they were manipulated and assaulted, while church leaders either ignored or actively suppressed allegations. Jane Doe, too, wrote in her lawsuit that she
walked into a nightmare. Cathedral Hall Academy was not a school. It was a trap.
Referring to the religious school run by the Millers, she added,
what should have been a place of learning became a place of control, fear, and unchecked abuse. Yeah, it was like a fake school. Like, the teachers weren't real teachers. It was like in a bowling alley. It was like all just to say it was a school, but really it was just another way to get access to kids.
100%. Both plaintiffs describe eerily similar experiences. Both say they were around age 15 when they were targeted by John Paul Miller. Both allege that Miller leveraged his position as a youth leader and pastor to gain their trust for sexually assaulting them on multiple occasions. Both claim the church, under the control of the Millers, failed to implement even the most basic safeguards to protect minors. Both lawsuits point to the suspicious death of John Paul's ex-wife, Micah, as a triggering moment that brought repressed memories of abuse flooding back. Man, that is rough.
Yeah, and one of them talks about, we'll get to their specific allegations, but I believe it's Jane Doe 1 wrote in her lawsuit, like, she felt an extreme amount of guilt when she saw what had happened to Micah, and then heard that Micah had been 15 when JP was an older, youth pastor. And the allegations were when these women were, I say women, but when they were 14, 15, and this was happening to them, that JP was 19, 20, older than them. And he's texted there's text messages that the plaintiff's attorney has in which he admits that when he was 19, he quoted dated 15-year-olds, specifically two 15-year-olds. I don't know if it's these two, which is the scary thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, she said when she saw what happened to Micah and heard that, like, she was groomed and that she knew, that Jane Doe knew she had been targeted before Micah, she was like, oh my gosh, if I would have come forward, maybe I could have saved her. And it's like, girl, no, it did not have anything to do with you.
Yeah.
A predator is a predator is a predator.
Yeah. Jane Doe 1, whose lawsuit was filed first, says she was just 15 years old when Miller, then 19, forced her into his father's office, where he groped her before dragging her outside and raping her in his truck. She says she repressed the memory for decades, only recalling it after a second assault in 2023. The lawsuit claims that on that more recent occasion, Miller leaned in
as if to hug her and shoved his hand down her pants, touching her genitals without her consent.
The incident in 2023 triggered the repressed memory of the first assault in the victim's mind. When she confronted Miller about his actions, he allegedly dismissed her concerns, citing scripture to justify his behavior, saying,
"No man is without sin and temptation. God understands that."
Micah's death in 2024 later brought all these memories to the surface, the lawsuit says.
Can you imagine? You were 15. He was 19. 15 to 20 years later, this happens. You see your abuser in public. You're frozen. She said she didn't know what to do when it happened because he leaned forward, grabbed her, and she said she didn't think her friend saw, and she said she completely froze and then worked up the nerve to go, like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, a half hour later, she's like, was stewing at this event with multiple people around because it's like, you just got groped in front of others. And she said when she finally confronted him, he fucking said, "No man is without sin and temptation. God understands that." That is what's nasty about Reginald Miller and JP Miller is repeatedly they try to manipulate and use scripture to basically justify their horrific actions, alleged actions, or are they alleged? I don't know.
They weaponize religion, and pretty much from the jump when they got into the whole religious business have done that. It's fascinating and sad and all sorts of things, what our brains do to protect us, that literally she suppressed that memory and consciously at least didn't think about it until something triggered it like that, because that's how traumatic it was for her.
Yeah.
And he, in front of a bunch of people at an event, like you said, all these years later, that was the first thing he did.
I'm like, you remembered that that's a person that not only
for sure
did he rape her, it was she had never had any sexual contact before. She was a virgin at the time. And also, she was not a regular member of that church. She was visiting her grandparents from out of town for the summer. That was the church that her grandparents went to. She was trying to go to Sunday school with her grandma. The grandma went into one room. The grandpa was in a different Sunday school in a different room. So Jane Doe was like wandering around, didn't know, because she didn't go to that church. Wanders into the cathedral. J.P. Miller's in the cathedral. Directs her somewhere, finds her in a hallway. She goes to the restroom. When she comes out of the restroom, he's waiting for her in the hallway, pulls her into the office, does what he does in the office, and then pulls her out. So you have this like 19-year-old guy grabbing a hold of you, and you're like, grandma and grandpa are somewhere like reading scripture, probably with his dad.
Jane Doe, too, similarly alleges that Miller used his church connections to groom her and other young girls. When she reported one groping incident to Reginald, Jane Doe, too, says she was forced to write 5,000 lines declaring,
"I will not lie about John Paul Miller,"
as punishment. She was bullied by other students after reporting JP, describing an incident in which
one student even held her down and sprayed bug spray into her mouth and eyes while others watched. Through it all, JP was there, smirking, encouraging, watching.
Reginald was no different. One day he found her crying. He told Jane Doe, number two,
"Stop disturbing the Lord's work and repent for your lies."
There were multiple additional incidents detailed in both lawsuits. Jane Doe, too, says that she, too, repressed memories of the abuse until recent events forced her to acknowledge what had happened.
And she was a student at the Cathedral Academy, and so she was had way more interactions with JP and goes into way more allegations, including sitting with JP early in her time at the academy at a piano and having him grope her sexually there. She also alleged that, like, there was, and that's what led her to report. And Reginald Miller screamed in her face saying, "You will not lie about my son," and then made her write all those lines. And then JP rallied the other kids. And he's an adult, by the way. He's 19. She's a 14-year-old student. He is an adult. Rallying is her allegation that these other kids would bully and abuse her, and he would like high five them and laugh with them and like have them be a part of it, made fun of her, berated her, called her names. And in addition to all of that, that Reginald Miller was also kind of a, I mean, he was a very abusive in his own right. When she brought a Harry Potter book to the school, he took it from her, burned it in front of her, told her that she was going to be raped by demons, and then hit her on the head with a Bible and poured water on her head. Like, just shit like that, where it's like, this isn't even close to a school. This is just two men running rampant, abusing people.
Yeah. And this is just a PSA for parents out there. Look into the type of places you send your kids before you just blindly send them someplace. I think a lot of these parents were part of the church, so they were also brainwashed and were like, oh, these are good people. We'll just send them along. But the second you hear something going on, even if it's the Harry Potter thing, that's when you leave. If someone is willing to do something like that, what else are they willing to do? Unless, and this is speculation on for anything involving a cult, because that's what I consider this. Sometimes the parents maybe are of the same mindset. Who knows?
Yeah, or, you know, kind of go, well, he's the pastor's son. Now you're just lying about him. And it's like, when you exalt religion over truth, when you exalt religion over family, when you exalt that, then it is a cult, because it's no longer a system of beliefs that informs your life. It has now become a system of belief that is controlling your reaction to things in a way that's like actively harmful to your own fucking kid. I mean, the allegations in the lawsuit were against JP and the parents, but JP and his parent. But certainly the question begs, like, what the fuck, man? And the Jane Doe one was like, I couldn't tell anybody. I shut down. You know, I was extremely depressed. Eventually, I just stopped talking about it overall. And then Jane Doe, too, said similarly. So I think they both sort of like in their mid to late teens after all this happened, just shut down and didn't even tell anybody about what happened to them until the stuff with Micah resurfaced. And it's that feeling we talked about in last week's Freaky Friday, where you don't want this horrible thing to happen to anybody else, but it almost is like a, oh my God, it's not just me. And I'm not crazy. I wasn't just having these nightmares about this guy's face. I see him on the news and I'm like, oh my God, that's the guy.
Yeah. And everything comes rushing back.
It really does.
At the heart of both lawsuits is the claim that abuse was not only rampant, but institutionalized within the Millers' network of churches, which evolved over time, but remained under their control. Reginald Wayne Miller, the father, has a long documented history of alleged misconduct. As we previously discussed, 1989 television investigation exposed accusations that he sexually preyed on students at a Bible college he ran in Florence, South Carolina. Rather than face the consequences, he relocated to Myrtle Beach, rebranding his ministry under a new name.
And there's that letter from Susan Miller, who was not JP's mom, if I'm recalling correctly, but was a ex-wife of Reginald, who was like, that all that was true. Like like a signed sworn affidavit saying he frequently preyed on young boys in the congregation. And then JP has said to others who have been quoted, including, I believe, his ex-wife, Allison, who also had a signed affidavit, JP's excuse for preying on teens and young women was that his father sexually abused him.
Yeah. Which, you know,
it could be true.
It doesn't seem like a huge leap to assume that that's true.
Yeah. They're sure close, though. I mean, again, you know, he's like, my dad did this to me. Therefore, that's why I'm a monster. And that's why I keep hanging out with my dad and keep doing the stuff. Like, to me, that rings hollow then. Like, I'm sorry for what happened to you when you were younger, but that does not give you carte blanche to continue to victimize people.
No, of course not.
Nah. Sinisterhood will be right back. Sinisterhood is brought to you by Progressive Insurance.
Fiscally responsible financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds.
Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way.
Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
John Paul took over leadership in the years that followed, but plaintiffs say he followed directly in his father's footsteps, both in ministry and in predatory behavior. The lawsuits argue that the churches under their leadership, including Solid Rock Ministries and All Nations Cathedral Church, were functionally the same entity, merely rebranded over time to evade scrutiny and maintain control over finances, congregants, and victims. One complaint describes the institutions as
an interconnected enterprise where the Millers ruled unchecked. And that's what the lawsuit's legal basis is, that any of the entities, by virtue of their bylaws being, and final decisions are Reginald Wayne and JP, no matter what, in perpetuity, is no longer a legitimate organization under the business code of South Carolina, which says you have to have a bylaws and a director and blah, blah, blah. Their bylaws were just like, whatever they want. And it's like, that doesn't count as an entity. And also, you knew that these allegations, like 1989, there's a fucking TV special that Reginald Wayne Miller is a sex predator. And then the entity has a separate responsibility outside of the controlling owners of the entity to put in some sort of policies that says, okay, that means no adult member of the staff should ever be alone with a minor child unless there's two other adult members, unless there's five other kids, unless there's some kind of policy. Mm-hmm. No, they had no policies.
Oh, no.
Is what the allegation is.
Policies. Yeah.
No.
It's so gross to me and scary how easy it is for people to just pack up and move and open a church under a new name. And there are so many churches these days. I mean, mm-hmm. especially where we live. Mm. And so many of them are just like community life church. You know, I mean, they're just
like anything.
Yeah. Individual churches that somebody opened. Mm-hmm. There's one in Southlake that just recently pastor was brought up on charges of sexual abuse of a minor and admitted to it.
Mm-hmm.
And now other people in the in that same church are being accused as well. But as a congregant, I don't know what you can do to kind of like fact check, or you know what I mean? Like, if you Google their names, maybe something comes up, but in 1989, I don't know.
Yeah, 1989, I don't think so. I mean, you would have had to have seen that news thing. And if it was a Florence news thing, you know, like if a pastor did something in Houston in 1989 and moved to Dallas and that news thing only aired in Houston, Dallas congregants wouldn't know. You know, I'm thinking about in terms of Texas for us, but like, you're right. Nowadays, it is so loose. And by virtue of, you know, the First Amendment, the state can't say, well, you have to have a certain type of license in order to be a church, right? Like we have this like true freedom of religion. So yeah, you have completely unqualified people just like designating themselves as pastors, designating themselves as leaders. And by unqualified, I'm like, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. It's everybody's right then to follow that person. But I think what our both of our concerns is, and I think as a public policy concern, is you don't want to have a ramshackle church that has no legitimacy operating under the auspices of legit, like we're a school. And it's like, in the to me, that's fraud. So that's the question is like, should we be able to then argue, okay, you're saying you're a school, but there's really not like a school aspect to it, or, you know, it doesn't really count. I don't know, because they would argue, well, it's our religious school and our religion says school, you hit children on the head, but I disagree.
I think that's a loophole though, that they use to one, get out of taxes, and two, be able to kind of make their own rules under the guise of the Constitution, using it to their advantage.
For sure.
Wrongfully so. One of the most damning allegations in the lawsuits is the deliberate suppression of abuse reports. The complaints claim that church bylaws granted the Millers absolute authority, preventing anyone from stepping in to stop them. Jane Doe number one's complaint goes as far as to call the church
John Paul Miller's sexual playground. And yeah, like the liability to an entity for third party criminal acts attaches to the extent that the entity knew or should have known. And it's like, y'all are the owners. So y'all know that y'all are molesters. So that's why you have to institute policies of people not being alone. And so it is kind of this catch 22 that I think the lawsuit effectively argues, which is the entity should have known. We're suing the entity. And also we're saying that entity should be disregarded because of the way that these men behaved. Check out the bylaws, check out their actions. You know, with all of that in combination, I feel like these are both very strong lawsuits. They have 30 days to respond. My two questions before I read the pleadings was, A, is there some type of church immunity? And there is like an ecclesiastic, the courts won't step in to judge when there's an allegation of a broken ecclesiastic rule or something like that. But the lawsuit successfully argues giving a preaching a sermon to a minor and the contents of that sermon would be something that would be inappropriate for the court to rule on. That's an ecclesiastic issue. Molesting a kid after you preach to them is a thing that the law, that's an action that the law is in charge of. So therefore, we're not alleging that they were bad preachers or that we had any problem with what they preached. We're alleging that what they did after that was breaks the law.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and then my other issue was the statute of limitations because these things happened like 15, 20 years ago.
But yeah.
Sounds like South Carolina law protects childhood sexual abuse victims who had suffered repressed memories, that if their memories were repressed, they have 3 years from the date of remembering to file suit.
I have a feeling more and more of his victims are going to come out too. That are not as long ago as 15 years.
No, I think we're going to see eventually some powerful image of this attorney because the same law firm filed both lawsuits. And I think we're going to see a powerful image someday with like 15, 20 or more women standing shoulder to shoulder kind of saying, you know, me too. Mm-hmm. And perhaps not just women as well, given Reginald Wayne Miller's predilection for young men, according to the affidavit from his ex-wife. So I hope that the victims see some justice from this, and it goes hand in glove with what Micah said happened to her when she was 15.
Yeah. Attorneys representing the plaintiffs argue that the Millers' pattern of behavior, combined with the church's failure to act, meets the legal threshold for gross negligence and institutional liability. So far, the Millers and their affiliated churches have not responded publicly to the allegations. So what do we think?
I hate that it's not a criminal complaint, but if it's anything, at least it is a civil complaint. The burden of proof is lower. And for anybody that was victimized, you want them to have their day where they get to declare this happened to me and this was not okay. They're all still alleged. I do think that given the affidavit from his ex-wife, I'm comfortable calling him a sex predator. And given the text messages from him saying that as an adult, he sexually preyed on 15-year-olds. So I have no concerns about defaming JP Miller at all, given the overwhelming trove of evidence, I think, that supports these claims.
Yeah, he's a huge piece of shit. Given the evidence, I would also call him a murderer. That's just my opinion. But
TBD
we'll see.
On that.
I hope that kind of like with Murdoch, the criminal or the civil stuff and money stuff kind of brings out the criminal stuff and it all gets tied together and it's all comes out in a trial.
Yeah, you know, it sort of was that dovetail with Alec Murdoch. The allegation was his money, he'd stolen all this money, his financial empire is collapsing, and that's why he's killed his family. And in a similar vein, I believe the evidence could show that Micah knew that this was ongoing, that the allegations in these civil complaints were that JP is sexually abusing young people at the church ongoing continuously, and also financial and fiscal funny business going on, which the Jane Doe lawsuits don't quite get into as much, but they do point to it as a reason to pierce the corporate veil, that's motive. Like, what do you mean? Like, well, he's just going to randomly kill his wife. First of all, stalking cases often end up in femicide. Domestic violence cases often end up in femicide. And also you give the other motive, which is I've called the IRS on him.
Yeah. And she had left him was trying to leave him and filed and he was for divorce.
Yeah. He was stalking her horribly. Horribly.
But go back and listen to our episodes where we cover her case specifically, because the whole crime scene was sus.
Mm-hmm.
Eyewitness or ear witness accounts at the time was
the
sus.
Call.
The whole thing. Yeah. It's her call to 911. All of it is very sus. There's also a ton of CCTV footage of perhaps the guy that was working with or for JP, kind of following Micah on the day of her death, which included her going to a pawn shop and getting a gun.
Yeah, just strange things that still have not been answered. And I don't think were well handled by law enforcement at the time. But my fingers are crossed, my toes are, everything is crossed that the FBI investigation not only unearths whatever financial improprieties were going on, but then is able to tie that to whatever else happened, given, like I said, just the overwhelming evidence, at least of him abusing her and stalking her as he did in their pretty much throughout their marriage, I would say.
Yeah. And his father abusing perhaps his own son and other young boys too. Mm-hmm. It's just decades and decades, just generational abuse and trauma, much like with the Menendez too. You know, it's, they kind of took two different paths there of being allegedly sexually abused by their fathers at young ages.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, the question is always, as from the public's perspective, like, what do we have to do to get you to arrest these people?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what, fucking listen to kids, listen to people, like, listen when shit like this happens. And maybe the JP Millers of the world will get stopped a lot earlier.
Well, let's hope. And we will keep everyone updated on all of these and any other cases that came up during this, too. The 15-year-old boy. And man, there's just there's never any shortage of true crime.
There really is. No, there's not. I mean, it was whenever usually we do three updates on a true crime headlines. And I told you this is a whole episode because, you know, our true crime headlines are usually like at half an hour, but this extensive, especially on the JP stuff. So we're happy to bring it to the main feed. Like I said, also selfishly, I want everybody to know about the JP lawsuit.
Yes, absolutely. Well, if you like our free episodes, you'll love our Patreon bonus content. You can join for free to see what we're up to next or dive into over 1,000 hours of segments like Judge Christie, where I rule on petty grievances you bring before the court. True Crime Headlines, where we break down the latest news and updates in true crime. Heather's Saves, where anything Heather has found late night scrolling could be discussed. and Am I the Asshole, Unpopular Opinions, and other subreddits that we feel require our input.
If y'all haven't listened to the most recent Judge Christie, we've got a full docket, and we'd love for you to check it out.
And the Heather Saves is coming up soon, too, which has an Am I the Asshole included in it, which was going to spark a lot of conversation for
sure. I think so. I had to hide that asshole in there. But if you're not sure what we're talking about or what we do, we also offer free trials where you can join for free for a week at any level, check out the perks, and cancel anytime before the trial is over without getting charged. We also have Join for Free, which is a tier, and you get some perks at the free level, including our Sunday Scaries weekly live stream at 8:30 on Sundays, as well as an archive bonus content that comes out once a month.
Mm-hmm.
What else we get?
Oh, you get ad-free episodes, monthly live stream Q&As on the third Thursday of every month, quarterly live bonus content, weekly audio bonus content, mini-sodes, merch discounts, and most importantly, a community of the best listeners on the whole internet.
Head over to sinisterhood.com, click shop on the top banner to check out Sinisterhood merch like t-shirts, mugs, tote stickers, and even clothes for your kiddos.
While you're on our website, you can also review the show, submit your odd but true tales for Freaky Friday, and send in whatever bizarre or hilarious video you want us to live react to during Sunday Scaries, our weekly live stream over on Patreon every Sunday at 8:30 p.m. Central. And don't worry, it's free. You don't have to pay for anything. Also on our site, you'll find fun things like topic-based playlists and information for Crime Wave at Sea 2025, mateys.
Yes, avast. November 3rd through 7th, come hang out with us on a cruise ship and take a vacation. Leave this all behind as we sail into the Bermuda Triangle. When we come back out on the other side, will it be the same reality? Will it be a different one? You tell me.
Fingers crossed it's not. But we'll have to wait until November to see, but it's going to be a ton of fun. Other true crime creators are going to be there. Henry and Ed from Last Podcast.
True Crime Campfire is going to be there. Scared to Death is going to be there. We're going to do not only performances, but we also have like fun events. There's going to be, I've heard, potentially karaoke, a belly flop contest. We're trying to figure out a game show situation. So
I'm trying to host a game show.
Yeah, Christy wants to host a game show. I want to be like on Win Ben Stein's Money whenever Jimmy Kimmel was like the sidekick. I want to be the sidekick. So we need to figure out what our game show is. So if you have game show ideas, sinisterhoodpodcast@gmail.com.
Wait a minute. We came up with a game show like a year ago. I'll give you $50,000
or whatever. We don't have $50,000 to give, though. We can't do that one.
No, we
can't
do that one.
We have to wait until ABC sponsors us. We need like a big corporate sponsor for that one. We do not have $50,000.
Unless Royal Caribbean is going to give us $50,000.
They're not
going to
give us $50,000.
We can't do that game show quite yet.
No, I'll give you $50,000 is out, but maybe we'll figure out another one. If you have an idea, send it in. But in the meantime, join us November 3rd through 7th at crimewaveatsea.com/sinister or go to our website for more info on the live show tab. And you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at Sinisterhood Pod. Like us on Facebook at Sinisterhood. Follow us on TikTok to see clips of the show at Sinisterhood Podcast. And you can watch us do live streams and stuff on there too.
Mm-hmm. And if you're looking for a unique and personal gift for the Sinisterhood fan in your life, or maybe you want to treat yourself to a pep talk, book a cameo now. From happy birthday to birth announcements to congrats on whatever accomplishment you have, we will create a customized video that can be immediately viewed and sent. Not only is it incredibly thoughtful, but perfect for when you don't want to deal with the hassles of shopping or you forgot to get a gift and now it's last minute.
No shipping time on that, baby. It comes to your email. Where can people find you on the internet?
I am on Instagram and Threads at Christy M. Wallace and TikTok at Christy or GTFO. Heather?
I'm on the internet at Heather versus the World.
As always, the devil rules the airwaves.
Keep it creepy. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. Here are your special Patreon shoutouts: Mackenzie Grogan,
Amanda M.,
Desiree,
Samantha Jordan,
Jesus Solis,
Bailey State,
Michelle,
Sarah E. Gray,
Angela Lang,
Jamie M. Elfison,
and Megan Bellamy.
Thank you so much for supporting the show. We could not do this without you. We sincerely appreciate and love each and every one of you. We hope we pronounce your names correctly. Stay safe, stay healthy, and keep it creepy.
Sinister.
We'll be right back. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
4th of July deals are on at Lowe's. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances, including the Samsung Bespoke French Door Refrigerator featuring Beverage Center and Dual Ice Maker. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Now's the perfect time to upgrade your home with top Samsung appliances and hot 4th of July savings at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.